From WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The premier Westminster Kennel Club dog show wrapped up earlier this week, and Best in Show went to a very hairy Pekingese named Malachi. But it takes more than one show to make a champion. Our guest today took a year to follow a rising star Australian Shepherd on the show circuit. And it gave him a behind-the-scene view of the world of dog shows and what it takes to be the best. This hour on Point, a show dog named Jack and the people who raise show dogs, who train them, judge them, and love them. You can join the conversation. Have you ever been to a dog show, seen one on TV? Do those pedigreed purebreds even look like dogs to you? You can also comment at our website on onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll talk to the handler and co-owner of the dog that won Best in Show at Westminster. But first, joining me now from New York City is Josh Dean. He's a writer whose work has appeared in Rolling Stone, GQ, Popular Science, and more. His new book is Show Dog, The Charmed Life and Trying Times of a Near Perfect Purebred. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Josh Dean, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
It's a delightful book, and the delight begins with a cover. This dog, Jack, clearly has got something going on, right?
He's sparkling. I like to say he chose me. Like the minute I met him, I sort of knew he was the one.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. So you essentially set out on a mission to follow this industry, this sport, for a year. How did you find Jack? Is that really true? He found you?
In a sense, it's true. It was the most daunting part of the project was choosing the dog, actually. At that point, there were, I think, 172 breeds in the AKC stud book, and to choose one just seemed impossible to me. I mean, you're talking about thousands of champion dogs in hundreds of breeds, and I just was paralyzed for a while. And then I went to the 2009 Westminster show, and this dog named Stump, an 11-year-old Sussex Spaniel, this is a breed I'd never heard of before, won Best in Show, and it was kind of a shocking moment. No one expected him to win, and I had this sort of a epiphany, if I can use that word, that it kind of didn't matter who I chose. Any dog was going to be a good story, I thought. So what I did is I befriended some handlers who handled the types of dogs that I liked, which are sort of athletic, mid to large, sporty dogs, a husband-wife team out of Pennsylvania, and I went out to a show and met their dogs, and one of them was Jack, and he was on top of a grooming table just kind of vibrating, as he often does, and I just kind of knew.
So tell me about Jack. He's an Australian Shepherd, right?
He is. When I met him, he was not quite two, which is quite young for a show dog still. He lives with his owner, Kimberly Smith, in the suburbs of Philadelphia. When I met her, she was a single mother of a teenager, and she had bought Jack as a pet. She saw a picture of him on the internet, literally a puppy picture, and couldn't get it out of her mind. And she looked all over. She knew she wanted an Australian Shepherd, and she looked at all the breeders in her area, and this one image was stuck in her mind. So he was actually in California, bred by Windstar Kennels, which is in San Bernardino area. And she struck up a conversation with the breeder. And what happens, I think, if you want a puppy that its breeder has deemed show quality as opposed to pet quality, often they'll make you agree or even sign a contract that says you will show that dog or at least try to achieve its championship, because that's what, with the best quality puppies, breeders want those dogs to become champions because that enhances their breeding program. Mm. So Kimberly had never shown a dog in her life. She didn't even have interest in it necessarily, but she really wanted this dog, so she bought him. And it was sort of off and running from there.
Well, there's so much to talk about in this book. It's an amazing sport. It's a fascinating group of people who get involved in it, a really sort of a peculiar and interesting and in some ways, I have to say, charming subculture of American society. It's big, too. But one of the details I was really interested in going through your book was how different breeds sort of attract different types of people associated with them. So tell me a little bit about that, and what kind of people associate with Australian Shepherds versus, say, the kind of people that associate with a poodle?
Well, the Australian Shepherd is a breed that's primarily still a working dog. These are arguably the best herding dogs in the world. I mean, Border Collies are known to be sheep specialists, so you will definitely hear people say Border Collies are better at sheep, but Australian Shepherds are versatile herding dogs that can work with cows and sheep and goats and geese, whatever you have. They've even been known to babysit children on ranches. They're incredibly smart, agile, active, high endurance, high drive, really want to please their owner. So the ownership group of Australian Shepherds tends to be a more outdoorsy. You know, a lot of the people who show them have farms and ranches or have kennels, and a lot of their dogs still go into herding programs, and they also will put confirmation titles on them as well. So it's I don't want to say it's a totally unique, but you would find this with Border Collies too. But Australian Shepherd owners don't seem like professional show people in the way that, for instance, poodles, which win best in shows more often than any other breed, probably. I mean, No one keeps total statistics to track that. But if you talk to anyone in the show world, anecdotally, they will say poodles win most often. And for that reason, poodles and breeds that win a lot of best in shows have wealthier backers and owners. You will find a lot of the top poodles, and this is true of some terriers and some of the other highly groomed or successful breeds, have what are called backers behind them.
And these backers are, even. So all kinds of money, a lot more interest, a lot more sort of riding on these poodles. Josh, in the book you mentioned early on that a lot of people, and I have to confess I'm one of them, get their ideas about dog shows and the people who work in them and who follow them from the very funny Christopher Guest faux mockumentary Best in Show. And I want to play a clip from that and then talk a little bit about it. So in this scene, two neurotic dog owners, Meg and Hamilton Swan, played by Parker Posey and Michael Hitchcock, try to motivate their dog Beatrice to win by using her favorite toy, Busy Bee.
What do you see in front of me? What do you see in front of me? You see a big blue ribbon. It's right here in front of you. You want it? You come and you grab it. You get it.
She's not listening to you. She's nervous. She's freaking out.
Well, get the Busy Bee. You want your Busy Bee. You get your Busy Bee.
You get the Busy Bee. I need to trim her whiskers. It's in the crate.
Where is it?
It's in the crate.
It's not in here. You left it at the hotel. You go back and you get her Busy Bee. Go to the hotel and get Busy Bee.
So that's a scene from Christopher Guest's 2000 mockumentary, Best in Show. Josh Dean, how accurate was that movie in portraying these people and the people who were involved in this sport?
I think one of the things that makes that movie so fantastic is that it is eerily accurate. I mean, it obviously picks on certain extremes in the culture, in the subculture, but everyone I spoke to, you know, when I first embarked on this and I show up with a notebook and a tape recorder, that's the question people want to know is, is this just going to be like Best in Show? And,
right.
And what they mean is, are you just going to make fun of us? And I would explain, I want to tell the true story of Best in Show. I mean, if it is indeed like that, then yes, the book will be like Best in Show. And if that's just right. Part of it, then that will also show up. But I suspect that there's a little more depth to it. That movie, though, all of those characters exist in real life. Every owner or most owners have a Busy Bee and probably would freak out if they lost it right before a dog show. I mean, as a father of a nearly two-year-old, I mean, my son basically has a Busy Bee. It's a little lamb stuffed animal. So I can understand this sort of panic about losing this toy that's so important to your dog. And what Christopher Guest did very well, I mean, the details in that movie are spot on. You know, all of it looks very accurate. And show people actually, I think, admire it on one level. On the other hand, it like makes them uncomfortable because it brings out the things about them that seem most ridiculous. The time that they spend, the money that they spend, the lengths that they will go to make a dog win ribbons. I mean, if you're on the outside, that seems preposterous. But once you're inside the world, it's kind of everything to these people.
So did you have to sort of persuade them that you weren't just going to do, kind of present them as a sort of freak show? I mean, how did you get through that initial wall of defensiveness, given what Christopher Guest had presented them in Best of Show?
Well, there was a period of, and I don't remember how long now, months perhaps, where I was trying to break down the wall. And I, at that point, I was just trying to befriend people enough to trust me to come out and meet them. And once I, to the credit of Jack's owner, Kimberly, and his handler, Heather, and her husband, Kevin, and the breeder, Carrie Kirtley, once I got to them, they were very open to having me around and really didn't put any requirements, or they trusted me to tell their story accurately. And really, I mean, the book would never have happened without them, because I often say, like, I don't know that I would let somebody with a notebook and a tape recorder follow me around for a year. I mean,
it's fairly trusting. And I have to say, you really do do a more nuanced presentation, depiction of this subculture. And it's a charming story, too, about a particular dog. And we're going to get to that. How has the book been received by this community of people who participate in the sport?
So far, knock on wood, very well. You know, I'm getting a few emails from people who were worried that I got some details right or upset that I didn't pick their breed. But the surprising thing to me, I very intentionally, when we went out for blurbs on the book, went to show people first. I went to David Fry, who's the director of Westminster, director of communications for Westminster. He's the voice of the show, and a respected judge and author and consultant named Pat Hastings. They got some of the first reads of the book because I felt like this would be the big test. If these people are happy with the book and feel like I did it fairly, then this is a really good sign for how the book will be received. And both of them were very complimentary and gave me great blurbs. And so I was very nervous before that point. Once I passed that point, I felt pretty good about it. And it's the amazing thing to me is how well he's an Australian Shepherd, and that's very different and not necessarily appealing to terrier people or borzoi owners or poodle people. But people are picking the book up anyway, I'm getting notes from owners of poodles who are just saying, you know, thank you for taking the time and effort to tell this story accurately.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about dog shows and the life of a show dog. And here's a moment from this week's Westminster Dog Show. A dachshund named Cheese appeared to stop in his tracks and demand a treat. Co-host David Fry commented on the strategies the handlers used to whip up the crowd and impress the judges.
You know, the handlers sometimes will let him do something that appears to be out of control, but it really isn't. They're trying
around,
to, I think,
please,
a lot of times get the crowd going for your dog. People are going to say, hey, I love the way that dog did that. I'm going to cheer for it. Carlos Puig and Cheese.
And Cheese, that's Westminster Dog Show co-host David Fry announcing the action at this week's Westminster Dog Show. And we're joined this hour by Josh Dean. He's author of the new book, Show Dog, The Charmed Life and Trying Times of a Near Perfect Purebred. Josh, I want to get back and really talk about the dog that you focused on. When we start the book, we learn that Jack has had early success in the ring, but when we meet him, we learn that he's struggling to meet his potential. What's going on with Jack?
Well, Australian Shepherds, and this is true of many breeds, probably aren't really mature and ready to be great show dogs until they're three and sometimes four, and Jack wasn't even two. And what happened is that when Kimberly, his owner, took him out and entered him in shows, he won very quickly. And just to backtrack a little bit, a show dog, the first step is to become a champion. And to become a champion requires a certain number of points, 15 points, and what are called majors. And that's, you have to defeat a certain number of dogs within your breed. That means he has to compete only against Australian Shepherds and wins enough points to get the CH that appears in front of his name. And at that point, you become what's called a champion. And a lot of people will then take their dogs off the circuit. But Kimberly had a handler at that point and was getting rolling, and he was winning. He was doing very well. And he actually had some surprising wins for a young dog that was totally unknown and unadvertised. So he was not quite campaigned, which is what you would call a dog that's out after its championship week in and week out trying to achieve points and rankings. And those would be the dogs you'll see at Westminster, for instance. So typically, a dog his age wouldn't have been out even as much as he would. So he won a lot of points. His handler got very excited about his potential. So he entered more and more. And then what happens is once you're a champion, you're suddenly facing other champions, and it gets a little bit more difficult. And every week, you'll be up against dogs that have been out for a year or two and whose owners might have been advertising them and who are more seasoned. And Jack was still young. I mean, he was an adolescent. He was physically mature, but mentally, emotionally, perhaps not.
And so he had the build, he had the talent of a champion, but here's what I liked about him. He seemed to be sort of rebellious. He didn't always cooperate in the ring, right? He would get distracted. He would do things he shouldn't do. Clearly a smart dog. He knew what was going on. I liked his cheek a lot.
I did too. And that's, you know, I very quickly knew I'd picked the right dog because they're show dogs can be robotic almost in that they become so good at what they're supposed to do that they kind of go through the motions. The great ones are the ones that are able to be perfect and yet still sparkle. And Jack was not quite there, but what he had was the sparkle. So he definitely seemed as if He knew what he was supposed to do. He could do it perfectly when he wanted to, but there were times when he just didn't want to.
So what would he do? Tell the listeners some of what he did, the sort of bad dogness in him.
he jumped on a judge or two. I saw him jump on his handler's back. He would not, fidget when he's stacking is that classic show dog pose when they have all four legs square under there. And that's when the judge can see the structure and assess how perfect they are. He would fidget in the stack. He would break out of his trot. I mean, you name it, he would do it. He had a period in the year when he was he would break out of line and go over to the corner and poop. that was his entering the dark. There's a few dark months in which he was really, I think, saying at that point, I need a break.
We're talking to Josh Dean about his book, Show Dog, and we've got a lot of callers standing by who want to get in this conversation. Let's take a couple right now. Anita is calling from Lancaster, Virginia. Hi, Anita.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, happy to do it.
I am overjoyed to hear this program. I am going out to get Josh's book. Josh, I have owned Australian Shepherds since 1978. I started the Ask a Breed Club in Virginia in 84. And I want to tell you I'm looking so forward to reading a book that at least your main dog that you chose is an Aussie, because they're wonderful, wonderful dogs. I have felt through the years, I call them the American cowboy dog, because basically that's where this breed was developed within the West when they came from Australia in the mid-1840s. And since they were such wonderful ranch dogs, they weren't registered until 1957. I call them the American cowboy dogs. But they're wonderful dogs, and I've got 20-some Barrett here at home.
That's fantastic, Anita. Well, thanks so much for the call, and I know you're going to enjoy Josh's book. Thanks for calling in. Let's go to Sam, who's calling from Nashville. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Anthony. How are you?
Very well. What's on your mind?
Well, my mom raised and showed wire hair fox terriers, and I was in the ring for her and went to a lot of dog shows and loved the dog people. You know, they were all her friends and my friends still, some of them. And the thing that I got from her is that it's a wonderful sport, but it's very expensive with all the travel, the handlers, and all of that stuff. You know, and if you get into advertising and promoting a particular dog, you know, like it could cost like many thousands of dollars.
And Sam, Josh Dean writes a lot about this, and I want to get him to talk a little bit about it. And I thank you for the call. Josh, can we talk about the kind of life that these people live? Jack's handlers, Heather and Kevin's schedule. It's intense. They're pretty much on the go all the time, every weekend. Explain a little bit about what it's like to do this sport at this level.
It's incredible. I mean, the professional handler, I mean, I guess I was sort of tangentially aware of their being before I did this book. You know, from Best in Show, I knew that there were these kind of dog coaches that prepared dogs for the show ring. But it is a very specific and incredibly intense job. And there's a little, you know, micro universe of these people who almost all apprenticed under professional handlers, because there's really no school you can go to. So it's like an old school trade. And basically they end up marrying each other, and Heather trained Kevin because she fell in love with the guy, and it was basically like, if you want to be married to me, you're going to have to get involved with dogs too. Because just for instance, in March, she recently told me they'll be home 3 days total. And so their week is typically, a dog show could be 2 days on the weekend, it could be 3 days, it could be 4 days. In some cases, it's 5 days, Wednesday to Sunday. And it often, there's a travel day on either end, so you could be gone 6 days a week, 7 days a week, 5 days a week. And then, you know, of course, the day that you're home, you're doing laundry and bills and groceries and cleaning the van and getting the cages ready. And when you're on the road, it's basically from the minute you wake up until the minute you go to sleep, because a handler or a team of handlers will have not just one dog. They'll have 5, 7, 10, in some cases up to 20 dogs. Then they'll have some assistants, obviously, in that case. But all
see, that
of those
was
dogs,
fascinating to me, and that's something that I don't think a lot of people know, that the handlers are handling many dogs at once, right? They're not just focused on one dog. So they're obviously each dog has separate owners, but these dogs get sort of farmed out to one handler who will handle more than one of them at any one time, right?
True, and very rarely would there be a handler with just one dog. Maybe at the very top. I mean, there probably were. I don't know if we can ask David later if Malachi was his only dog out. I think that's possible. But you would need, in that case, you would need an owner with a lot of money, and Malachi did have a substantial backer behind him.
Well, you mentioned David, Josh. Let me just because you sort of started the introduction. Let me bring in David Fitzpatrick. He's a veteran, multiple award-winning professional handler, and he was the handler and co-owner of Malachi, the Star Pekingese, who won Best in Show at Westminster this week. And here he is. Let's hear the announcement from Judge Cindy Vogels.
With seven wonderful and worthy contenders tonight, I have but one ribbon. Best in Show at the 136th Annual Westminster Kennel Club America's Dog Show is the Pekingese.
The Pekingese, named Malachi, and David Fitzpatrick was his handler, and he joins us now. David Fitzpatrick, congratulations and welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Anthony. My heart started pounding hearing that announcement again right now.
So, yeah, take us back there, especially people who didn't watch it on TV, who don't see these events on a regular basis. What's going through your mind at that moment? Lots of hard work, and here comes the announcement. What are you thinking?
Well, you're hoping and you're dreaming that the judge may pick your dog, and you're, you know, more than that, you're hoping your dog just gets out there and shows well. And doesn't, you know, disappoint you in his performance, you know, when you're showing at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah. And what did Malachi do so well to win Best in Show?
Well, I think what he did so well is he remained true to his breed. You know, he stayed calm. He walked slow. You know, he acted dignified. And, you know, he didn't start racing around the ring and, you know, overdoing it. The Pekingese, you know, has a very special gait, of course. And, you know, in order to appreciate it, the dog has to walk slow and dignified.
We have a clip about a Pekingese special gait, which I'd like to play if we can get that queued up. And by a special gait, you mean what you mean is they walk slowly. So when Malachi, the Pekingese, was being shown in the toy group, we can hear co-host David Fry and Mary Carrillo describe the way he walks. Let's listen.
A beautiful dog, Malachi.
And right around the ring for me, please.
David Fitzpatrick, the owner-handler here from East Berlin, Pennsylvania.
Wait, he's going to go all the way around the ring? This could take a while.
I don't think he's going to follow him all the way around the ring, but we'll check back later.
So there it is. What do you think when you hear that? When you hear that, David Fitzpatrick.
Well, I
because of course you don't hear that in the show, right?
You don't hear it, and you know I've been around Pekingese for 42 years, so you know I've heard it all, and you know they are what they are. They're little dogs with short bowed legs, and they weren't bred to move quickly.
Yeah. David, we were talking to Josh Dean about the lifestyle that this sport requires. You're on the go most of your life. I just wanted to know what attracts you to it.
Well, you know, it starts out, you know, we all love dogs. When I was a child, you know, I couldn't get enough dogs. Dogs, dogs, dogs. And then I discovered the world of show dogs and going to dog shows, and I just got hooked, you know. And then I, you know, discovered the Pekingese breed, and they liked me, and I liked them, and here we are 42 years later.
Well, David Fitzpatrick, thank you so much for joining us today, and again, congratulations on Malachi's big win this week. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
That's David Fitzpatrick. He's a veteran, multiple award-winning professional handler, and he was the handler and co-owner of Malachi, who won Best in Show at Westminster this week. Josh Dean, let me come back to you. Tell us about dogs like Malachi, and here's where I'm going with this question, and you wrote about this quite well in the book, and I want to be delicate the way I phrase this question because I don't want to offend dog owners. I know how they can feel about their dogs, but Jack is a kind of dog that you just immediately look at, love, relate to. There are some breeds, the Pekingese come to mind, where you look at these dogs and say, why would anyone be attracted to a dog like this? You know what I'm saying? And I'm just wondering how you dealt with that and how you sort of made sense of that.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I've heard a lot since Westminster, like, how could that dog win? That's not a dog. And I'm sure people who are toy dog fanciers and enthusiasts get pretty offended by that. I just think there's a reason when the dogs, well, like Uno the Beagle, for instance, or you often hear that if a golden retriever or a lab were to win, that the garden would erupt, or you know, the Dalmatian and the German Shepherd seem to be crowd favorites. I just think that for America as a whole, a dog is the family dog is a big kind of happy, goofy dog-looking dog. And then there is a whole, you know, there are 185 breeds now, and a lot of those are small breeds. And you know, they're very intricately styled and groomed, and I think that people, it's a bit more of an acquired taste. You know, I actually think that Pekingese is really cute. I understand why people might not totally be into the way that, you know, and if you're the kind of person that gets a dog to go running with you or to take out on walks, then the Pekingese is not going to be your dog. But it was bred to be a lap dog. And sure, there are a number of breeds bred for that reason, just to sit on the laps of royalty in Asia and keep them warm in those really cold palaces.
We're talking to Josh Dean. He's the author of Show Dog, The Charmed Life and Trying Times of a Near Perfect Purebred. And let's take a call. David is calling from Amherst. Hi, David. Amherst, New York. David, good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. To paraphrase Josh, I'm going to have to poop on the topic of today's show.
Okay. Say a little more about that, David.
The reason being is I've been a dog owner for over a dozen dogs, owner and trainer. And for 30 years, I've boycotted all dog shows because I feel they objectify the physical aesthetics of the dogs. And in the same way you wouldn't want your children to be judged on how they look, I feel that they really, I don't object to the people who participate in the shows, but I object to the effect it has on the American pet-owning public. They pick breeds because of the way they look, not because of how they behave.
All right, David, it's a great point, and I'd love to give Josh to respond to that. Take it away, Josh.
I'm glad he actually raised this point, because I think that a very popular misconception about dog shows, and I had this idea when I started this project, was that dog shows really are just beauty pageants where the judge is essentially picking the most attractive dog in the ring. That's not really what's going on. It's called confirmation, which is the real name for dog showing, as we know it at Westminster. And what a judge is supposed to be doing is looking at a dog and comparing it to what I call in the book the Grecian ideal of that dog. So in the case of the Australian Shepherd, the club sets out a very, very detailed set of rules about what the size, bone structure, how the ears are carried, what the tail looks like. I mean, the Aussie doesn't have a tail, but how long the legs are. And it's not arbitrary. These are dogs, and Aussie is a herding dog that has to do a very specific thing. It has to be agile and strong and fast and smart and independent and be able to get through burrs and thorns and arroyos and canyons. And so what they're looking at is, like, how well could this Australian Shepherd do its job? And the way they know that is by how well it looks like what the club has said an Australian Shepherd should look like. And that's the case with every breed. And I think what happens, it's trying to be scientific. Is it always I'm sure it's not. Judges have preferences, and judges actually breed dogs too. They all come from dog backgrounds, so they're probably going to have preferences, and within the breeds, some dogs might have bigger heads, or a judge might prefer a particular coat color or pattern, so you're going to have preferences. But at least the theory behind it makes sense, and the last thing I would say about that is that what breeders are trying to do is produce the best stock. And the way they do that is they choose the best animals, breed them
to
the best
animals.
Josh,
I'm going to just ask you to hold that point. I want to come back to this point about judging. I also want to pick up the point that David, our caller, made. But we have to take a short break. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Josh Dean. He's author of Show Dog, The Charmed Life and Trying Times of a Near Perfect Purebred. We're having this conversation during the week of Westminster when a Pekingese named Molokai won Best in Show. And Josh, let me just come back to David, the caller's point. He used a couple of words in there that I just want you to respond to, because this did sort of occur to me, and it just raises a question that I'm genuinely interested in, and that is, he said, you know, you wouldn't want to objectify your children, suggesting that this might be cruel to dogs. Is it? Respond to that. Are show dogs happy to work in this sport? Can you get a sense that they're actually happy doing this?
I think they are. I don't think there's certainly nothing inherently cruel about what's going on. What dogs, most breeds, or you know, all dogs want to do is make people happy. I mean, they're our companions. We literally invented them. We have been breeding them for thousands of years. into specific archetypes, and they do jobs, and they want to hang out with us and make us happy. And what dog showing is a kind of a game, and they do these series of tasks that they've been taught, and they're rewarded with affection and treats. I think that sometimes people worry that, you know, they're on the road away from their owners, and maybe that's fair, but I think the handlers treat them very well in most cases. They're well taken care of. They, you know, they do spend portions of their day in crates sometimes, but dogs, I mean, anyone who knows, has a dog and has crated it before, knows that dogs often find comfort and safety in their crates, and they are exercised and watered and walked, and they get to hang out with a bunch of other dogs. And I think generally what's going on is fun for them. I think a dog is never happier than when its human is happy. And, you know, these are dogs that have several humans who love and look after them, their owners and their handlers. And often the breeders are still very involved, too.
Well, let's take a couple more calls. Chris is calling from Charlton, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Anthony. The point I wanted to make, and I'm a multiple dog owner, where I have two Dobermans, and although we don't, you know, we don't breed them and we don't show them. Our lifestyle doesn't really accommodate that. But I find myself and my wife, we watch the dog show, and we kind of, you know, kind of root for your own breed. It's like watching your team in the Super Bowl, you know. And we had Fifi this year, I believe, the Doberman's name, was a great contender. And I think that comes back to the campaigning, too. You know, I knew the dog's name before it was even in the show, and I said, I want to see how Fifi does against the, you know, the other dogs. And you know, unfortunately, she didn't take it this year. But just like the Patriots, there's always next year, I guess.
There's always next year. Keep rooting for those Dobermans. Thanks so much for the call, Chris. We appreciate it. Let's take another call. James is calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, James.
Hi, Anthony. My question was concerning the underlying motivations of these people that show dogs. Like psychologically, what kind of people are these people? Because I have a classic car, and I enjoy showing a classic car. But I also realize that the car is an inanimate object, whereas there's almost something almost eugenic about this seeking to create the perfect breed. Of course, we know this is something that's not possible with human beings, because we don't have the same genes that allow for the just, you know, almost endless possible breeds that you can make with dogs. Dogs, I forget the name of the gene right now, but it just seems to be like there's almost, it's, I wonder what kind of person attracts this kind of lifestyle. Like I said, I can understand it for something like, you know, cars or, you know.
Okay, James, the question's a good one. It's on the table. What are the underlying motivations for people who show dogs, Josh Dean?
Well, for breeders, it's the draw is enhancing their breeding stock and trying to identify the best animals in order to reproduce that breed. But for the average dog show participant, the owners, and I should say that what you saw at Westminster, generally those dogs are campaigned and have professional handlers and large budgets. But the average, if you went out to the dog show that comes through your town, you know, once a year at the fairgrounds, a lot of the people participating are just owner handlers who do it on weekends, and it's just their hobby in the way that some of us play golf or tennis. And I think there are two things at work. One is competition and winning, the same reason we play golf or tennis or poker or whatever it is that some of us might choose to compete in. And the other thing is that there's a strong pride, a sense of pride at work, where dogs are second only to children, I think, in a person's heart, and if you don't have children, first. So you love this dog with such intensity, and in your mind, you know, almost every owner out there thinks that his or her dog is the most amazing, beautiful, smartest, you know, agile dog that they've ever owned. So what better way to have that reinforced than to enter a dog show and people tell you and give you ribbons and say your dog is the best? And that happens over and over again, and when it doesn't happen, you start making excuses for why it didn't happen, and you say there's always next week, and then next thing you know, you've been in it for 42 years, and you've got a garage full of ribbons and trophies and a small bank account, probably.
Josh, we've got a great comment here on our web from someone who calls him or herself Westie Lover. We are not peculiar or weird. We respect the true nature of the dog. I love the West Highland Terriers. At the show, they are white and fluffy. At home, they are dirty and sticky. They are proud. They kill rats. So there's a, there's a reflection of what kind of person is involved in this sport. And then there's a question, Josh, from Alicia Abbott. Can your guest comment on the effect of the shows on dog breeding trends? Does high demand for winning breeds hurt other breeds, or eventually hurt the winning breeds when the demand tapers off?
You will hear that Actually, a lot breeders don't like to see their breeds win shows like Westminster or the AKC National Champ, Yukonuba National Championship, because it does create demand. And I mean, there are two problems with that. One, there aren't enough quality dogs often to satisfy the public. And the other thing is that, you know, you're getting a lot of people who are making an impulsive, emotional decision, and dog ownership should never be taken lightly. And in the case of many breeds, it's not easy. And it's funny to listen to what I love listening to the announcer at Westminster come up with different euphemisms for saying this is a difficult dog breed, because you'll hear it over and over again. And the nice thing about responsible breeders is that they won't lie to you about that. They will tell you exactly how much the dog sheds, how long it's going to live, whether it's difficult, how it is with children, you know, whether it can live with cats, is prone to chasing cars, because it's very bad for them to give away dogs and have those dogs returned or taken to the pound. And that they love all their animals, and they want to be sure that the person who adopts it is the right person. So actually a run on dogs can be a problem. And there was, you know, like when the Obamas adopted Portuguese water dogs, there was a bit of reaction in the Portuguese water dog community of like, is this a good thing? Because we don't want everybody suddenly to have a Portuguese water dog.
And what about the dangers of overbreeding? This is another point you made in the book, that these competitions, they do a lot in terms of helping to keep breeds alive, but you write that it also leads to cheating and overbreeding. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, right. The idea is to find the right animals that you should be reproducing, and the ones with the fewest or no genetic flaws. But you know, in every breed's case, you're working with a closed gene pool. I mean, that's how they're created. You are inbreeding. At least at some point you were inbreeding. With healthy stocks, you've now got enough that you can produce healthy dogs. But there are going to be genetic flaws and problems in every breed. And what you're trying to do is, DNA testing is helping now, but you're trying to pick out the dogs that have those flaws and eliminate them from the program. But sometimes, I mean, unscrupulous owner handlers will have dogs that they know have flaws, and they'll try and cover them up. For instance, if a tail or an ear is not right, they could have cosmetic surgery to make the tail set right. Or you can actually, white is often an indicator of blindness or deafness, and you could dye a dog. And what happens when you do that and that dog wins, then people want to breed to that dog. And then what you've done is you're reproducing those, magnifying the bad genes out into the gene pool. And that's a really bad thing. And there have been some cases where dogs, I know some cases in Europe where I think there was a German Shepherd that had a very serious genetic problem that was not discovered until later. And that dog bred like several hundred times. Now you can imagine, multiply that by all the puppies that came out of those many breedings, and you've suddenly created a problem where you shouldn't have.
Sure. We're talking to Josh Dean. He's the author of Show Dog, The Charmed Life and Trying Times of a Near-Perfect Purebred. Let's take a couple more calls. Nancy is calling from Cohasset, Massachusetts. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Anthony. I'm calling from the perspective of a golden retriever breeder, owner, trainer, shower in dog shows, and I want to address the family aspect of a breeder owner, which I think is very positive and we haven't talked about yet. For my two teenage daughters, who are no longer teenagers, and I campaigned several golden retrievers, which were breeder-owned, and enjoyed the on-the-road situation, which Josh has explained or described so well, taking off. We were amateur handlers. My daughters and I handled the dogs ourselves, and we finished several champions that way. We also, the girls, I did not, the girls also ran them in obedience trials. And we also trained these golden retrievers for the field. I think Josh has made a really important point that active, working, sporting dogs are exciting to work with.
Hmm. And Nancy, it suggested, and you're suggesting as well, that it was a nice thing to do together as a family, right?
Yes, I think that's really the reason of my call.
Sure,
it was a super thing to do. These girls were athletic, my daughters, and they showed the dogs, also athletic dogs, beautifully. And there is a certain cachet about being a breeding, owning, handling family.
Well, Nancy, let me put this to Josh, because he touches on a related theme in this book, I believe, Josh, or comment any way you want, Josh, on Nancy's call. But I was recalling one of the things I read in your book was just how many couples actually do this together, because folks are out on the road so much that it's sort of lonely if you're involved in a relationship and the other partner isn't involved in this business.
Certainly that's true of professional handlers. It would be very lonely to be a single professional handler. You'd go back to a truck full of dogs. I mean, I guess that's worse than going back to an empty truck, but I think what she's talking about is very common. There are a lot of families who do this, you know, multi-generational families, and that's both on the professional handling side. You'll see fathers train sons, mothers train daughters, fathers train sons, and even grandchildren, third generation now, but more so, if you walk around the benches and look at all the dogs being groomed, and what you'll see is, you know, within the particular breeds, well, some breeds are very competitive and not friendly, but often, you know, the people all gather every weekend, they get together and they talk about their dogs and they hang out and they make chili, and it's almost like tailgating. And in the case of the handlers I followed, Heather and Kevin, they would have, you know, say they had 10 different dogs that weekend, and all those dogs have owners, and those owners all come out week in and week out, and it becomes this, like, mini community within the larger community where they're all sitting around in folding chairs and gossiping and, you know, talking politics and you know, just making fun of other people's dogs and talking about why their dogs are so great. And it becomes this tight-knit community. And I actually fell into it because I was with them all the time. So I felt, you know, these people became friends. So people that I would see every week and I looked forward to seeing.
Let's go to Lee, who's calling from Cambridge, Mass. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Anthony and Josh. Fascinating show, and I'm looking forward to reading the book. I own a show-quality American Cocker Spaniel, but I have concerns. I had no intention of ever showing her. I have concerns about show dogs in that I wonder, at least at the top competition level, I wonder if they're really ever allowed to be true dogs. Are they allowed to run through the woods the way we do and get trashed? Because some of them certainly require a lot of grooming. So I want to put in a word to those people who have dogs, would love to compete with their dogs, are put off by the sort of objectifying your dog aspect of the shows, for agility, which is a way cool thing to do with your dog. Builds a wonderful bond, wonderful communication, is terrific fun to compete in. And my dog and I just love doing it.
Well, Lee, thanks for the call. And let me get Josh to respond to that idea you put out there that these show dogs, Josh, are never allowed to be true dogs. They can't run through the woods, chase things, get dirty, and, you know, just be a sloppy, happy pet.
I can certainly speak for Jack in that that is not true at all. Jack is a dog first and foremost. And he would, you know, this one of the underlying tensions in the book is between his owner and his handler. His handler, you know, wants to take the potential of this great dog and make him into a, you know, a top-notch Australian Shepherd, and that requires some level of dedication and being out every week. And then his owner, Kimberly, loved him like a child and didn't want to give him up that often, which you can understand. And I think this probably goes on in every handler circle. And I think even the top dogs, the ones that are out with their handlers full-time, are being allowed to be dogs. They may get less time in the woods. They're probably not playing frisbee necessarily when they've got a big dog show coming up because they could get injured, but definitely you'll see dogs running all over the outdoor outside of a dog show, whether it's, if it's an indoor show, all the RVs are set up in the parking lots, and it's probably true that they're not having as much like time in the woods as a family dog would be, but they're all also generally, even the top campaign dogs are only out for a year or two, or in extreme cases, three. And then what happens is they go back to live with their owners. And so I think that most of them are still regular dogs.
Josh, you obviously love dogs, and I'm sure that was part of the motivation for you to take on this project. I'm wondering, after spending a year following Jack and this industry, how your view of dogs, how your feeling about dogs, for dogs, evolved or changed?
It intensified my both my love and my respect for them. I think that I always had a very visceral emotional reaction to them, although I haven't owned one in a while because I live in an apartment in New York, and the kind of dogs I like are dogs like Jack that are, they'll do fine in apartments, but I sort of would prefer them to have more space than that. So this is a discussion my wife and I are having now that we have a son who loves dogs. But I've come to respect how smart and devoted and incredibly diverse and surprising that they are. I mean, each one of these breeds was bred to do something very specific. And even if they don't do that job anymore, they have the sort of hard wiring for it, which makes them, you know, interesting. And each breed has its own distinct personality. So I think it's endlessly fascinating to me to learn about all of these 185 breed types and growing, and what made them be the breed that they are, what makes them dogs. And I think that they're capable of doing so much that it's an emerging field. Dog psychology and our understanding of their intelligence is pretty new, and it's burgeoning, really. They're smarter than we thought they were. They're capable of doing all kinds of incredible things, like detecting cancer and invasive species and they make
our lives so much richer and happier. Josh Dean, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Josh Dean. He is the author of Show Dog, The Charmed Life and Trying Times of a Near-Perfect Purebred. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.